I'm going to chant Hare Krishna just for a few minutes before I begin speaking. Please accompany me. I'll chant first and then you can repeat after me. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Krishna. Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Samaniti Namane Namaste Sarasate Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sanyavari Hasta Chade Satarane. Hare Krishna. So my name is Naranjana Swami, and I have been associated with this temple for 47 years. And actually, previously we had our temple elsewhere in Boston. It was in North Beacon Street in Alston, but we moved here in this building in 1974. And as it was mentioned, I used to be the temple president here. And when I was the president here, one of my favorite activities used to be to go to the different colleges and speak to the students. We had at that time what was called an ISKCON Speakers Guild. And I used to communicate with the different department heads and the other people who accompanied me. And we used to request if they were interested. Especially towards the end of the semester, all the professors used to like to bring in different people for their students when it was a lighter time, especially towards the end of the semester, to introduce Krishna consciousness. Or sometimes it was comparative religion courses. Sometimes it was courses on Hinduism. Sometimes it was courses on sociology. Sometimes it was courses anthropology, different topics. And I did that for quite some time, and I got an opportunity by going to these different universities and to speaking to the professors and to the students to capture a little bit about what student life was about, having been a student myself, University of Massachusetts. And I always had an interesting experience. I just thought of it. I thought I would share with it to you. This was, in fact, one devotee who was here. His name is Muktavanya Das. He was with me. Is he? Where is he? He's upstairs. Okay. Oh, he's on the altar. Okay. I don't know. Does Boston State Teachers College still exist? No. I don't think so. I heard it went out of business the year after I was there. used to be on Huntington Avenue. And I was, one student had contacted me, and often at that time, as I said, we used to, many professors would come, would call us, and students used to come here also, to find out a little bit about our society, about our daily activities, about our beliefs, our lifestyle. And one student had called me once, and she asked me, would you come and speak to our class? Our professor would like you to come. And I asked when the class would be. And then she told me the date, the time, and said, I will meet you out in front. Please come. And I will bring you into our classroom. So at the previously scheduled time and day, I went to meet the student. It was a young student. And, it was a health education course that was being taught at the time. And I was escorted up to the front of the room to sit down and wait while some students were sitting in the front. And the students were sitting as a panel. And we're having a panel discussion. And the panels were discussing different religious, at that time, they weren't known as religious groups. during the 1970s, it was a time when everybody in America was concerned about cults. I don't know if that's the concern these days, but it was a big concern in the 1970s. They were called NRMs, New Religious Movements, which we were at the time. We had only been established in the Western world since 1966. So I was told to please sit down, and I would be asked to come and speak in a little while. And then one by one, there was four desks with two students with each desk, and they were meant to present their results of their research, their findings that they had done extensively on the particular NRM, or New Religious Movement, which was they were assigned to study. I don't remember what they were. I think one of them was the Unification Church. One of them was Church of Scientology. So I can't remember. And one of them was International Society for Krishna Consciousness, or the Hare Krishna Movement. So the first three presented their findings, and I began to wonder why I was invited, because it was quite of a presentation that the students were making about, you know, mind control. I thought it was well connected to our little skit here about the mind how the mind, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, for one who controls its mind, it's his best friend. One who fails to control the mind, it's his worst enemy. And he also says, if one conquers the mind, he reaches the super soul, is reached, he attains tranquility for such a person. Heat and cold, happiness and distress, honor, dishonor, they're all the same. Controlling the mind is something which, at least nowadays, many people have begun to understand a little bit about its necessity. And Krishna has says, if you don't control the mind, it's your worst enemy, because just as the bottle was held out, the cigarettes, everything else, the movie tickets, the mind is always looking for an object to strike. And because the mind is never really pacified, it's like trying to put out a fire by pouring gasoline on it. You pour gasoline on the fire, it may temporarily be extinguished, but as we know, gasoline also promotes a fire, and you can't put it out by pouring gasoline. So anyways, at least there is some understanding in more modern society than from back then, that there's some advantage to learning how to control the mind to achieve peace. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that if one is not connected to the Supreme, he can have neither a controlled mind nor steady intelligence, without which there's no possibility of peace. How can there be any happiness without peace? Anyways, back to this little, I don't know what to call it. I didn't know what to call it at the time. I thought it was a presentation that I was supposed to make, but began to realize as the fourth group began to speak and spoke about the mind control of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the things that we did, like rising early in the morning, chanting this mantra, living what externally may appear to be like an ascetic life. In many ways, people were convinced that we lived a life of deprivation, and we spent most of our time chewing our nails in frustration. Because we had been indoctrinated to think that this activities that we were performing in Krishna consciousness was detrimental to one's physical and mental health, because it was a health education course. So after they presented their findings about the dangers of the Hare Krishna movement, the professor who was sitting in the back of the room said, will you please stand up now and answer the questions of the students? So I said, well, how can I answer the questions of the students, especially with the portrayal that was just made by these students is a little bit misleading. And he said, no, we didn't bring you here to speak. just answer the questions. And I was a little feisty. And I decided that before I would answer the questions, that I would try to explain, at least to help the students gain a little insight, is what is the difference between a genuine system of religion and a dangerous, quote, cult. And I thought that I had the right to do that before answering questions. So I began speaking, and the professor didn't want to hear me speak. And he said, He said, stop speaking. We don't want to hear from you. Just answer the questions. And I continued talking, and I began explaining what is a genuine system of religion. Is that which teaches its followers to develop devotion to the Supreme. Any institution, religious institution, which teaches its followers the principle of love and how to love the Supreme, how to be connected to the Supreme, and how to display love for other living beings and understanding the spiritual nature of all living. I tried to go into depth, and the professor was getting frustrated because I wasn't relenting. And finally, he started screaming. And one student stood up and turned to the professor who was sitting in the back of the room and said, let him speak. Why don't you let him speak? Another student got up and she slammed her fist against the desk and said, turned to the professor and said, let him talk. Why can't we hear? What are you trying to do? Brainwash us? And then another student got up. And before you know it, half the class was standing up in complete revolution against the professor, who they were convinced was leading a brainwashing session for all of them. And then I ended up, for the rest of the class, the professor had to slink down in his seat because the students were revolting. Had to slink down his seat, and he sat there and he had to listen to me complete my presentation for the next, whatever it was, 20, 25 minutes, establishing the benefits of controlling the mind and establishing the benefits of the lifestyle and practices of our Krishna consciousness movement. There was no time for questions at the end. Class was over. But by that time, all the students came up and took books. Everyone was just taking books like anything. And then at the end of the class, when it was time for leave, I was walking out of the door, and the professor who taught the other students of the health education courses on the other side of the hall, who listened to my presentation, said, will you come tomorrow and speak to my students? So the next day I went and I spoke to the students again, and the same response was there. And as I said, I heard... the year after, the Boston State Teachers College, it doesn't exist anymore, it went out of business. So I guess maybe because it was teaching courses of that nature to the students. But it's interesting because I saw, as I was looking at this little skit about mind control, and some people may object. They may not fully embrace the need to control the mind, but my experience through the years that I was here as the president and going to many of the colleges and universities, many of the students at that time, and I would think even more today, can relate to the pressures of student life. And I mean, I know I was subjected to them. University of Massachusetts, I was living in the And I was living in Amherst. I was living in an experimental dormitory called Project 10. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a co-educational dormitory. And there's definitely a lot of pressure. And I won't tell you the kind of things that I subjected myself to while living, but if you can imagine, it was the 60s and early 70s. Our generation was definitely a drug culture, and that's what was going on in the universities predominantly, and many of the students were looking for a counterculture. And because of the pressure and because not wanting to conform to the lifestyle and to the dictates of society, it was a very revolutionary time in America. But control of the mind, and one of the things when I would go to the students and I would give the lectures in the local universities when we had this ISKCON Speakers Guild, one of the most common questions the students would ask me after hearing about our lifestyle, practically every place I went to, is, what do you people do for fun? They can't figure it out, you know, like, they think that we just, that we sit around a life of asceticism, we sit and meditate, and we rise early in the morning, especially when they hear we rise 3:30 in the morning. It's called, most often it's called, what do you do at such an ungodly hour? Why are you doing it at 3:30 in the morning? Rising in early in the morning and coming together and chanting, hearing the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, and learning how to actually begin to experience some higher state of awareness, a higher state of consciousness, which is came to be well recognized as self-realization. I oftentimes tell this little story, and I'll probably end with this because I don't want to speak too long tonight. But I spent a lot of time in Taiwan. Taiwan is a place where many of the people are really obsessed by gadgets. of course, I think it's not just Taiwan anymore, but it's most places people are really obsessed by gadgets. And anyways, I use this example to the Taiwanese people sometimes, especially when I'm meeting them and introducing this concept of self-realization, which means to create a greater awareness or understanding of who we are. You know, beginning of teachings of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that, you know, for the soul there's never birth nor death, nor having once been does he ever cease to be. He's unborn, undying, eternal, primeval, ever existing. He's not slain when the body is slain. Krishna says, Dehi no smin yatha dehe komanam javaram jara, that the embodied soul continually passes in the body from boyhood to youth to old age. Similarly, the soul passes into another body at the time of death. Dhiras tatra namuyati, one who's dhira, one whose mind is dhira, self-satisfied, he's not bewildered by that change. This is the very ABCs, basics of Bhagavad Gita. All of you know these things. I mean, many of you, you know Parvati, Shiva, you know Yashoda, Nanda, you know Lakshmi, Narayan, you know Radha, Krishna. But yes, these are the different incarnations, but they come to fulfill a particular purpose. And the particular purpose for which they appear in this world is to attract the living beings of this world to a higher state of consciousness, which is transcendental. So oftentimes I use the simple analogy, especially, as I said, in Taiwan. Then, I don't know where iPhone is these days. What number are they at? 10, okay. So I so I used to tell them things like, I have an iPhone 11, and I have an advanced version, and I'm going to give it out to somebody tonight. I want you to have it. And people, of course, are really, of course, as soon as iPhone 10 comes out, people want to know what it does, what the things it does. Of course, now it's what the XS. I guess that means excess. Is that what it? Or is the 10 is the excess? Something must be excess. I'm not talking about XS, I'm talking about EXCESS. But anyways, I say something like, I have an iPhone 11 and I want to give it to you. Or I say, if somebody wants to come forward and give you something, then and nobody else has it, then and it's a gift. And somebody says, here, take it, it's yours. Now, everybody knows what the iPhone 10 does, but what does the iPhone 11 do? It must do something that the iPhone 10 doesn't do. So immediately they want to find out, what's the potential for the iPhone 11? Most people will go online, they'll go to the Apple Store, they'll go to the website, they'll get a manual, whatever it is. What does the iPhone 11 do that the iPhone 10 doesn't do? You know, you want to use it to its full potential. It's natural. Mm-hmm. So I use this simple analogy also to help our listeners to understand. Similarly, the human form of life is a very valuable gift. An intelligent person should try to understand, okay, I have this gift. What is its full potential? Now, someone may say, if they have an iPhone 11, well, I'm going to use it to make phone calls. You could do that with an iPhone 2 or 3 or whatever it may be. What do you need an iPhone 11 to make phone calls? You want to, you have a something that does a lot. Same way, human form of life has the potential to do a lot. And the lot that it has to do is a lot more than just simply to gratify the demands of the body and the mind. It's very simple. Bhagavad Gita is meant to teach. It's very simple things that, yes, you can do all of these things. It's not that they have to be given up, but how to have peaceful mind under the pressure, under the stress of all these things. Srila Prabhupada used to use the simple analogy that if you have so many zeros, you add them up to equal zero. But if you put in one in front of your zero, the number one, every zero becomes significant by the presence of one. Right? If you add one in front of your zero, the first zero is significant. You have 10. You have two zeros, each zero is significant. You have 100. More zeros you have, the more significant they become because of the existence of one. So in the same way, if we add, learn how to add something to our life, that's all. Add Krishna consciousness, add it to our life. We don't have to give anything up, we add. This is self-realization. Human life is meant for self-realization. Why should we waste it, the valuable human form of life, simply to gratify the demands of the body and to have better forms of gratification for the future? Better to meet the necessities of life and at the same time understand that the actual goal of life is how to become connected to the Supreme and of wealth, as Krishna says, without which there's no possibility of peace. If one is not connected, he cannot have a controlled mind, nor steady intelligence, without which there's no possibility of peace. How can there be any happiness without peace? So these were our simply elementary thoughts that I thought I could share with you this evening. And as I said, I was first introduced to the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita in 1972. I had left college in 1971, and I started studying Bhagavad Gita as it is shortly afterwards. And I met my spiritual master. Sometimes people ask me, when did I first meet my spiritual master? And my usual answer is in 1972. And they say, where do you meet him? And I tell them I met him in a bookstore. And they say, what was he doing in his bookstore? And I say, he was sitting on a shelf. And some people can't understand. What was your spiritual master doing sitting on a shelf? And I try to explain to them that I missed my spiritual master when I came in contact with Bhagavad Gita as it is. And began reading that book in 1972. And I can say that although this lifestyle that I adopted subsequent to coming in contact with my spiritual master taking initiation from him in 1974, becoming his disciple, and subsequently, as it was said tonight, taking to the renounced order of life and traveling as I do worldwide. Many of my desires were fulfilled. I always wanted to travel, and I can't tell you how much I travel now. But now, instead of traveling looking for something, I feel I have something to share. So every once in a while I come, and I'm always very happy to visit Boston, and especially to see all the students who I used to see regularly when I would hear as the temple president in 1978 and 79, 80, 81, I can't remember those years. So please come, take advantage of this temple. Take advantage of these events that we have, such as the event we had tonight, and have a good time, because it's satisfying to the self to remember actually there's more to life than simply smoking cigarettes, drinking, and taking intoxications and going to the movies. There is some happiness when the students ask these questions. What do we do for happiness? We tell them, actually, there is a lot of happiness in all of this, but it takes time to experience it. The example is that if a person is afflicted with jaundice, he can't taste anything sweet, but sugar is the cure for jaundice. And the more one eats sugar, the more the sugar becomes sweet. So in the same way, the jaundice is compared to be avidya, ignorance. If we've been afflicted by the jaundice of avidya, then we cannot experience the sweet taste of the simple activities that we do in Krishna consciousness. But if we do them and take part of them, gradually we'll begin to see they're very satisfying to the self. And actually, when the self is satisfied, the mind becomes more peaceful, we become more effective and much more productive in our life. And actually, we begin to get a sense of what is real happiness. It's not just gratifying the senses. Try to use this body for its purpose, fulfill the actual purpose of life, and not simply waste it in us for sense gratification. Use the human form of life to its full potential, and try to understand what its full potential is. Thank you very much for your time, and for giving me this opportunity to be with you this evening. And I think now we're going to have other activities. And I think Vanamali Pandit is going to speak to you. Yes? Oh. Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna.
Minutes
for any one question.
Just raise your hand.
Nobody's raising their hand. Okay, yes, in the back. I'm sorry.
So, actually, as a student, we have a dream of achieving something great. So, dream can be getting a good job, having a high salary. So I think we get more connected to the material world when we have such big dreams. And on the other hand, in case of spiritualism, we talk about self-realization and to focus on meditation and how to remove the connection from the material world so that we can, just end our desires and have eternal peace. So sometimes I am in a state of confusion regarding whether to go forward and achieve the dreams in the material world or whether to focus on the spiritualism part. So I feel I am in a state of contradiction. So how to clear this confusion, basically?
It's interesting that you use the word dream. I would like to use a little analogy that's given in Srimad Bhagavatam to give a little insight and to answer your question. There are verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam which describe that although the duality of this material world does not exist, conditioned soul experiences that is real under the influence of his conditioned intelligence. I will give an analogy that is given in this verse. He compares to the act of dreaming and desiring. He says, when the conditioned souls of dreams of something desirable or something very horrible, or when he daydreams of something he would really like to have or something that he would really like to avoid, he creates a reality which has no existence beyond his own imagination. I'll explain. I use this analogy because usually most people can relate to dreams. Is there anybody here who's never dreamed before? Okay, maybe I'll ask it the other way. Who here has ever had a dream before? Okay. Some of you didn't raise your hand, but I suspect it's because you're intimidated. I'm sure everybody has dreamed before. But there are good dreams and bad dreams. Sometimes we have a good dream. Like sometimes, whatever you call it. Good dream is, I landed a good job. Good dream is, I've got this person I've been meditating on for years has come forward and expressed some interest in me. Good dream. Whatever it may be. Whatever you want to call to label as a good dream. Usually a good dream makes you happy in the dream, and when you wake up, you're sad. Why are you sad? Because you look back and say, it was only a dream. But when you have a bad dream, and I oftentimes give the example myself, as I said, I travel a lot, I fly a lot. Sometimes I'll fall asleep in the plane, and I have this experience that the plane is dropping very quickly. I don't know why it happens. No, maybe something from a previous life. I don't know. But the plane is dropping very quickly. And I wake up. And I look around and see everybody's normal. And if you have a bad, or you're dreamy that you're being devoured by a tiger. And you wake up. Generally, when you wake up from a bad dream, you're happy. When you wake up from a good dream, you're sad. When you wake up from a bad dream, you're happy. But what is this happiness and distress connected to? It's not connected to reality. It's connected to a dream. But yet the happiness and distress is so real. So similarly, this is the night dream. So there's two types of dreams. There's the night dream and there's the daydream. We dream of something we would like to have and something we would like to avoid. Generally, people, they dream of something that, yes, if I have this, I'll be happy. We live for that, fulfillment of that dream. And because oftentimes we feel that the fulfillment of that dream, all we can see is the benefits and the potential happiness of its fulfillment. But we don't see all the potential implications and problems that come with the fulfillment of these dreams. Like, just like sometimes, I oftentimes give an example, like a wealthy person. Sometimes it's very hard for a wealthy person to know who his friends are. He's wealthy, he got his dream, he has huge wealth, but why is this person my friend? Does he want something from me? Does he? And therefore, he's very discriminating who to make friends with. So he was so much thinking that the happiness he would get, the fulfillment of his dream, but when the dream is fulfilled, there's other complications there. The daydream that he would like to have fulfilled, or the things he would like to avoid. Everybody dreams of the things they like to avoid. So just as there's the night dream and the happiness and distress which is connected to the night dream is not connected to the reality. The happiness and distress which is connected to the daydream. And therefore the verse goes on to explain that such persons who are in a state of duality, their reality has no existence beyond their own imagination. They create their reality, but it's simply their imagination. Happiness is more than just simply the fulfillment of these dreams or the avoiding of these dreams. There's more to that happiness. So you experience, as you said, you experience a little conflict, internal conflict, because generally people do. I mean, I definitely experienced it, internal conflict. How to, you know, I was thinking also when I read Bhagavad Gita as it is, my first thought was, boy, this book really requires some deep commitment. And I said to myself, I'm not ready for this. I put it on the bookshelf and I tried to forget about it because I didn't feel like I'm not ready for such commitments. But again, my perception of reality changed a little bit because I could understand that is more than just what these external perceptions are. I want to go deeper and try to understand more. But therefore, that conflict was there within me also. And I'm sure you'll find many people experience that internal conflict. But in Krishna consciousness, the conflict that is there is because we don't yet know who we really are. We're still basing our whole lives on a conditioning of however many years that came previous to coming to that point of questioning. And what to speak of, as Krishna states in the Bhagavad Gita, not only previous years in this life, but the conditionings of previous life. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, living entity carries its different conceptions of life from one body to the next, just as the air carries aromas from one place to the next. So these different conceptions of life are carried from the previous life into this life. We're conditioned by it. Therefore, how to become freed from this conditioning? It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing. Conflict will be there. But how to resolve it? The best way to resolve it, and this is how Srila Prabhupada introduced Krishna consciousness to me and gave me a sense of wholesomeness. Because generally we get into this mindset that spiritual life means all or nothing. Spiritual life means give up and go this way. In fact, even Arjuna asked Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, what happens to the person who takes to the spiritual path but doesn't complete it? Does he become like a riven cloud with no sphere of existence in the spiritual path or in the material path? What happens to him? We understand it's not all or nothing. Krishna says in this endeavor, there's never any loss, never diminution. A little advancement in this path will protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. The wholesomeness of Krishna consciousness doesn't come from having to reject artificially. The wholesomeness of Krishna consciousness comes by giving a purpose behind the studies, giving a purpose behind the goals that you want to achieve. Nobody says you have to give up these goals. There's something to be achieved. There's some benefit to be derived. But what is the ultimate purpose of these things? Is it simply to be utilized so I can enjoy my body into greater pleasures? And I'm willing to make all the sacrifices now because of the pleasure I'll get for the future. I say, why have an iPhone 11 when you're doing iPhone 2 business? What is the benefit? You have a human form of life. Why use the human form of life simply to live with the anticipation of greater pleasure in the future because of my achievements that I'll get in this life? There's more. Kamasya nendriya pritya labo jiveta yabat lavata jivasya tatva jigyasa nato yeshaha kamabhi. Life's desires shouldn't be directed simply towards sense enjoyment. One should desire to live because the human form of life enables one to inquire to the absolute truth. This should be the goal of our work. Utilize the human form of life by adding something. That is all. And you'll see that when you add, you won't lose your determination to do it because you have a purpose for it. The purpose is you want to do it to please Krishna. Krishna doesn't say you have to give everything up. 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he makes it very clear. If you can't do this, then work for me. If you can't do this, if you can't work for me, then give in charity, give sacrifices. He gives so many different ways that persons can live and work. Don't don't have to give up these goals, but put them in the right perspective. That is all. By adding the one to what potentially could be nothing but zero. Just add one. Srila Prabhupada taught that. And that's what convinced me, because I began to see that, yes, I didn't have to. When I put the book on the shelf, said, I'm not ready for this. Then I began to say that, well, no, actually, there's many things. When I dropped out of college, I became a carpenter. I was working. I was building houses. I used to do carpentry work. I used to fix houses and get jobs from different people. And when I came to the temple and visited the temple said, oh. Devotee said, oh, could you help us with your skills? Could you? And I found myself doing this. I can tell you another far story, but I don't have time for it. it's just adding, giving a purpose behind all the things. I'll tell you the story. It's a simple story. Can I? I don't know. Yes? Yes. It's a simple story. After I dropped out of college and I was living with some friends, we were living like hippies. And I was living, it was 60s, 70s, everybody was hippie back then. Long hair, everything. And we lived in a communal type living setting, and the kind of philosophy was, do what you want, just don't get in anybody's way. And nobody, and we were all vegetarians actually. Even in those years, we were vegetarians. Everybody who lived us, our philosophy behind vegetarianism is because each and every one of us had a dog. There were about 15 of us lived there, and the 15 dogs lived there too. And we used to think, you know, why should I kill a cow? I would never kill my dog, so why should I kill a cow? So we all decided, but practically simultaneously, we became vegetarians. So we used to cook for ourselves. I would cook for myself. But yet, I was learning in the beginning of Krishna consciousness that when you cook, you should cook for Krishna. And when you cook for Krishna, everything should be clean. So I would go into the kitchen, and hippies don't like to clean. In fact, you go in the kitchen, and usually every time I go in the kitchen, there was usually a huge stack of pots, and there was nothing clean. If I wanted to cook, I had to clean everything first. So I would go in there and I would start cleaning and I would do the cooking and cook a little bit and then offer something to Krishna. And I was doing that repeatedly. I was trying not to become resentful, but a little bit of resentment was growing. And then one time I visited the temple. And it was the Boston temple and our old temple in Alston. I spoke to the devotees. I was just learning a little bit about Krishna consciousness, and I had read a little bit of the Bhagavad Gita. And we talked for a while. And then the person said to me, would you like to do some service? And I said, sure. I want to do some service for Krishna. So he took me into the back room, and in the back room was this huge mound of pots. I mean, it made the mound of pots that I was cooking with my hippie friends looked like, you know, just a few dirty dishes. There was a lot of dishes. He said, maybe you can clean the pots. And I was thinking, is Krishna playing a joke on me? I do this all the time. I started to wash a few of the pots. And then one devotee came up to me. And he turned to me and he looked at me and he said, when you clean Krishna's pots, you clean your heart. I heard this and I truly tried to meditate on it. I was thinking, yes, these are not ordinary pots. These are Krishna's pots. And as soon as I began thinking that way, as soon as there was a purpose, that the purpose of washing these pots is because they were Krishna's pots, I became so enthusiastic and so enlivened. I felt so purified, spiritualized. Simply, I was doing the same thing that I was doing in the other place, and which I was resentful and throwing the dishes and the pots around. But now, just because of the consciousness, I was doing it for Krishna, everything changed. 180 degrees. Felt like I was introduced to the spiritual world. So it's the consciousness that we do things. It's not what we do, but the consciousness that we do it in. We have to learn the proper consciousness of all the work that we do. Everything that we do in our life, whether it's rising in the morning, raising children, taking care of our family, going to school, studying with our friends, cooking, cleaning, whatever we do, it can be all, if done in the right consciousness, then it actually can satisfy the self. So therefore, my humble recommendation to you, because your question was so very good, don't live in conflict. Try to learn how to add Krishna. That is all. Just learn how to add. Learn how to add one to what could be potentially something not very substantial. Learn how to add that. And don't worry about giving up. That's not the requirement for spiritual life, to simply artificially reject and renounce things, which is not the fundamental teachings of bhakti yoga. And that is the best recommendation I can make to you and to others who may have similar thoughts about the fears of renunciation and conflict and taking the path of spiritual life. Thank you. Hare Krishna.